It sucks the life out of you. I know a lot of people like Toronto, blah, 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 blah. But
Well,
for
the mayor
us,
does crack, so, you know.
But yeah, I mean, right?
You're stepping into the ring with two guys who pull no punches. This is Entrepreneur Showdown.
Hey, 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 happy Monday morning, everybody. It is time for the Entrepreneur Showdown. I'm Dan Franks. Joe Cassandra, he's my partner in crime. He'll be coming on in just a bit. He'll be stepping in the ring with me for a couple rounds of hard-hitting debates that actually Ray Brown, one of our listeners, left us a feedback at showdownlove.com. Told us that's his favorite part are the debates that Joe and I have. So, Ray, you got some of those to look forward to in the first two rounds. And then, of course, we got the main event, the infamous main event, home of the pull no punches, cut the crap entrepreneur interviews. We got Jill Stanton from Screw the 9 to 5 stepping in the ring with us for the main event. But before all that, remember, for the show notes of today's episode, a whole lot more, you can head on over to entrepreneurshowdown.com. But with that, let's get on with the showdown.
Round one.
Today for round one, Joe and I are looking at something that is near and dear to my heart because it's something I struggle with, and it's ways to make the most of your time. Really, this is kind of a productivity talk and a efficiency talk, and Joe, we've talked about this before. This is something that I really struggle with, and we're kind of referring to an article from Jane Wilmot. She's guest blogging at shetakesontheworld.com, and she wrote an article called 6 Simple Ways to Make the Most of Your Time. And as a somebody who struggles with this type of thing, anytime I see these headlines, these are some of the ones that appeal to me. So I just want to jump right into some of her tips and tricks and see maybe if you agree or have any additional ones to throw out there. But one of the things that she likes to do is put together some sort of daily plan. And I've noticed when I do something like this, when I write down my goals for the day at the beginning of the day, or sometimes before I go to bed, I'll write down the 5 most important things to take care of the next day. I really feel like that's a good start. That gets me a jump start on my time. However, what I struggle with when I do this is I'll put, you know, a dozen things on the list, and I think, oh, this will take me 8 hours, when in reality, maybe I can get through 3 or 4 of those. And I don't take the time to really prioritize the most important out of those 12. And I end up still kind of all jumbled about and not being efficient. Do you ever do any kind of writing down of, you know, the daily plan or anything like that?
I have, and I know that it works because when I need to use it, it works. I guess I run into the problem of I worry if it's like something, a new type of idea that I'm trying to hash out, I always procrastinate a little bit because I'm always worried about, okay, well then what's the next step after that, after I do those steps? But I guess just instead of digressing, every time that I write certain steps down for the day that I need to get done, I always get them done, because it's kind of, you're creating like an accountability, even if it's just for yourself, because everyone loves to cross stuff off a list. That's why.
Love it. Love it.
I mean,
that's what I was going to say.
Yeah. Like Sam, my wife, she loves making a grocery list just so she can go through the grocery list and just cross off stuff. But
okay, but so that can become detrimental though too, because if you put everything on the list, everything that's going to take 5 minutes or 30 seconds, and you got this list of 40 things, you're spending as much time having fun crossing things off the list. I mean, there's got to be some kind of balance to where you're only going to put, you know, important things, and there's some, you know, smaller things that are going to happen throughout the day that you don't necessarily have to write down.
I mean, if you put 40 small things, that's not going to be as great as if you put 10 medium-sized things. I mean, that's just a psychological thing.
Right.
I mean, if you see 40 things on the list, you're automatically going to be like, I'm not going to do all those today.
Well, I find it interesting that you mentioned that sometimes when you write things down, you don't necessarily focus on what's written down, but you actually like to think about what's coming after that in the next step. That kind of defeats the purpose. And this is another point that she mentions in this article. She says, break it down. So if that step you write down does have something that you're worried about after it, Well, make sure that's written down too, so you can see right in front of you, I need to go step A before step B before step C. Because if you see step A and you know there's a couple other things after that, but you haven't written them down, that again, back to that psychological thing, you need to break down what you're going to do. So you can't just write, you know, we mentioned you can't write 40 things on the list, but you also maybe shouldn't write one or two things on the list. You really need to be strategic about how you present it to yourself and how you conquer these tasks.
But how do you get over the step of, okay, here's an idea I have. I know I have to do this step, but I know after that step, I'm going to have to do that step. But I know after that step, I'm going to have to do that step. How do you get over the fear of worrying about that next step and just doing that first step?
Like, well, it's all psychological, right? I mean, you have to at some level be able to convince yourself that, okay, I'm so worried about steps, you know, C, D, E, but obviously if I don't, you know, conquer A and B first, I'm never going to get to that. So somehow psychologically, you have to get yourself in the position to not worry about that. I mean, you know it's coming, but focusing on C before A or B, it's not going to get you anywhere.
Well, let's just look at the podcast conference you're co-running. I'm sure there's steps down the line that you're thinking of that you're dreading taking those steps. But how are you not wasting time worrying about that and managing the task that you have to do right now?
Well, it's tough because, like, right now our website is Kickstarter. Everything's going to Kickstarter, because that's where it's at right now. That's where everything, all the focus is going, because without the Kickstarter, there's nothing to happen. But meanwhile, in the background, I'm worried about all these things that are supposed to happen after Kickstarter, when in reality, my time could be best used spreading the word about the campaign and spreading the word about pre-ticket sales and trying to engage the audience and trying to engage the speakers to engage their audience. You know, running ads, working on copy, all these things that I could be focusing on now, when in reality, I'm trying to tweak the website that is already put together, the website that's going to go to the podcast conference after Kickstarter's over. It's already, the framework's already there, and I don't really need to be spending time on it, but right before we started recording, I just spent 2.5 hours tweaking little crap that'll probably get tweaked another 20 times. So, you know, I'm, as I mentioned in the onset, that's something I'm really bad at. But I don't have anything written down. I'm like Sam, your wife, when I write things down and I have it in front of me, and I'm like, this is what I need to get done today before I stop. I can do that, because while I maybe, you know, jump around from thing to thing to thing, and I'm bad about multitasking when I really shouldn't be, I'm also good about knowing what needs to get done by a certain time, and I always manage to get it done, if that makes sense. I don't know if that's how you are. I know a lot of people, if I don't get something done today, I'll get it done tomorrow, no big deal, and they just kind of keep, you know, kicking the can down the road, and that's not me. So I think I'm at least good about knowing what needs to get done and being able to get it done.
I'm trying to figure out a way for me to kind of get to that point, because I know if I write it down on a physical piece of paper, I feel like that works for me. If I put it in my calendar, though, for like, hey, make sure you do this today, that doesn't really motivate me as much as if I have like a
list. You're saying when the reminder pops up, the snooze button's a lot easier to click than anything else.
Exactly. Instead of throwing out the piece of paper, it's easier to just click snooze, dismiss, whatever, and that's gone. And once I click dismiss on a calendar notification, I'm never thinking of that again.
Yeah, it's tough because a lot of people now use Evernote or these kind of tools or whatever their iPhone apps are that keep track of things like that, the to-do list, and it's really easy to kind of, you know, close that program on your phone or hit ignore or hit cancel or do something like that. Whereas if you have something physical in front of you, it's that physical task of crossing things off the list, and we keep going back to that. But I think since that's the most effective for me, that's what I can relate to more than any of these apps. So I think, you know, putting some kind of structure in place, and obviously this isn't a one-time deal, this is something that has to be developed. You know, if you're whatever it is that you do, whether it is on the side like we're doing with the podcast, or whether it is some small business or some online business that's your full-time job, you have to have some kind of system that you stick to, because habits form and routines build. And when you can start getting those wheels in motion, turning at a constant pace, it's a lot easier to keep things going then than just, you know, trying to jump around.
Well, I know one way to make the most of your time, to be efficient in a certain way with certain tasks, is sure, you write it down, but then you also let other people know about it. And I'm sure we've talked about this before, but, and you mentioned it recently when your Kickstarter reached its goal. Its goal was 11,000 and now it's way beyond that. But you said, like, okay, you hit 11,000, like, now we have to do this. And it's not something that, now it's like you're obligated to do it because now there's people counting on you to do it. And it's the same way as if you tell someone you're going to do something. I mean, if you're a stand-up guy, hopefully you are, whoever's listening, that if you said you're going to do it, then you're going to go and do it. And if you fail at it, it doesn't matter. You still went and tried and did the best you could to try and get the task completed. But when you let someone else know about it, it makes it, I don't know, there's just something that clicks in your brain that you kind of force yourself to do it in a certain way.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought this up, and I think this is a great point to end on, and it's probably the most important, and it's a little funny that this is what we're concluding with, and it's nothing to do with her article. Her article didn't mention this, but accountability is huge. And a lot of us who have full-time day jobs, and which I'm guessing a lot of our listeners have, it's kind of taken for granted that you have somebody that's counting on you, somebody that's maybe not babysitting you, but you know they're holding you accountable. If something doesn't get done, you know, their fury is going to come crashing down on you. Whereas if you're doing something on your own, even if it is just a side hustle, you're accountable to yourself unless you put those systems again in place. So, for instance, like you said, with that conference, the Kickstarter was a system that was put in place, and now I'm being forced to do that. Of course, I want to, but there's people counting on me now. Likewise, if you communicate your desires, you communicate your ambitions, or even if it's your small tasks, you communicate your deadlines to somebody that can hold you accountable. And you hear this term accountability partner. That can be anybody, but you just have people that you share this with in mastermind groups or whatever it is. And I think that's huge. Being held accountable, having people to, you know, come down on you and people to remind you if you're not accomplishing your goals or your tasks at the rate that you've told people you would. I think that's big. Do you have anything else you want to add to that before we wrap it up?
I mean, just getting other people to first see what your goal is and what your vision is. It just does a huge thing for not just your motivation, but also just your discipline in when you know that people are counting on you. And like, for example, we were talking about this just before, but like, I have like a meetup group that we meet for like couples dates and stuff like that. And people are always asking me, hey, when's the next one? When's the next one? And I organize them, and that automatically creates, since I'm putting it out there, that automatically creates an obligation for me to keep putting together more of them and keep bringing people together. It would have been easier to just have the idea and talk with like my wife about it, and then nothing ever happens because it's not out in the world. So basically, you have to put it out in the world at some point, and there's going to be people that are going to ignore it, and that's just going to happen. But then there's going to be other people who want to know more about it, and they're going to want to get involved in it in whichever way possible. And once people start getting involved, then you're more likely to stay motivated in a certain way. That's why a lot of people quit online ventures and whatnot, because they feel like no one cares anymore. But when you just get that one or two people to start saying, yeah, what are you doing now with that project? Or what are you doing now what's your next step for your conference or whatever? That automatically motivates you in a certain way when maybe you are at a point where you were thinking about giving up on it.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's a very surefire way to give yourself accountability partners, is to put yourself in a leadership role and have people counting on you. And people, you know, it's a lot easier to stay accountable when you're the one that people are looking up to, as opposed to being one of the people at the bottom looking up. Because if you're at the bottom, it's a lot easier to drop out than if the people are counting on you. So I think that's a good point too. And to wrap it up, kind of tying back to my conference, like you mentioned, that's the same thing I am. Who are we? We're, you know, two small-time entrepreneurship podcasters who met a fair number of people while we're doing this and have made good connections and, you know, get a few hundred downloads a day of people listening to what we have to say. But immediately when I put myself, no one put me there, in the position to run this conference, all of a sudden it's almost like the tides have turned. Then the people that, you know, we're trying to reach out to, all of a sudden they're the ones, you know, coming to me and holding me accountable. So I think it's an interesting way to look at it, and an interesting way to almost force yourself to be accountable if that's something you need to do. But anyways, take it, listener, for what it's worth. Go, you know, if you're stuck in traffic listening to this right now, roll down the window, ask the guy next to you if he'll hold you accountable. If he says no, pull forward a little bit and do it again. But with that, let's get on to round two.
Round two.
For round two today, we're looking at a post by Jill Stanton, and Jill will be coming on in the main event, but for this post, it was actually a video post, but there's a transcript as well. She talks about the difference between niche sites and authority sites. And Dan, I know that you've dabbled in some niche sites. What are your thoughts when you think of, should you go the niche site route or should you go the authority site route?
Well, I mean, it's completely different thought processes. If you're going to go authority site, you're investing into a time-consuming process. You're investing into something. I mean, like entrepreneurshowdown.com, that's almost like an authority site, somewhere that you're going to dedicate a lot of time, a lot of resources, you know, whether it's your time or someone else's time that you're paying for. You're going to be building up something and trying to sustain it. So an authority site typically has to be kept up to date. It has to be, you know, talk about current events, things that people want to come back to. So you're not just trying to get these one-off visitors. You're really trying to get people to come in, look around for a while, and come back next week to see what updates you made. So that's an authority site. A niche site is a lot more like some of these spammy things that a lot of people work on, you know, for affiliate links or, you know, Google AdWords type sites. So that's kind of what their article is doing, is comparing the two, maybe helping someone determine which one is better for them. And I think the biggest thing that they talk about here, and I would concur with that completely, is the time commitment. These little micro niche sites almost, that some of their stuff they advocate on their site for, is these things that you can kind of set it and forget it. You put some ads up there, you write some good copy, you get ranked kind of high in Google, high enough to get some traffic in there, and then you kind of move on to the next one and hope it performs. And if you strike it rich on one of them and one of them really starts taking off, then maybe you dedicate some time into that. And that's maybe something I want to talk with her about in the main event is, hey, what's that process like if you build a bunch of these little micro niche sites and then one of them actually takes off and it starts getting traffic, and for whatever reason it ranks super high, super quickly. What's the process of taking that and turning that micro niche site into an authority site and really capitalizing on that traffic that's coming?
Well, she has a bunch of sites with her husband. I think they're over like 20 sites right now. But then they have their main site that I guess they're trying to make into an authority site. But then they have all these other ones, and I couldn't find any of her affiliate sites. Maybe I didn't dig deep enough.
Well, I mean, that's the kind of thing you don't really share, right? I mean, you get the Spencer Hawes thing where you share what you're doing that works so well and you give an exact example, and next thing you know, somebody's ripped you off completely and are outranking you. So, I mean, I understand the logic behind not sharing all of your things, and unless you're doing something public like, you know, Pat Flynn's niche site duel or something like that.
So are a lot of people, they're not putting their names to these niche sites? Is that why?
No, I mean, when I did it, and some of the courses I took that, and they even talk about, they've taken some courses as well, teaching them how to do these things. But everything I read and everything I did, you really kind of use fake names. I mean, take Pat Flynn. He has a security guard training. I'm not sure it says Pat Flynn anywhere on it. Now, because he was public about the project of creating it, everyone knows it's his. But other than that, people wouldn't know that it's his, that he's got it going. So I think those are things that you kind of keep on the down low for a variety of reasons, really.
Well, I guess then it depends on what your goal is. If you want to be a figurehead in the space, using Pat Flynn as an example, you're going to want to try the authority side. But as she says in the video, it's going to take a lot of upkeep. You're going to be spending a lot of time branding. And I feel like it probably may take a lot longer to make any money off of it, because you're just spending time trying to just build your brand as being someone high up in the space, while a niche site, you can immediately, the very first day, you just throw up an Amazon link or whatever type of affiliate links there that they use. But you're never going to, people aren't going to see you as, in her case, they make a lot of their money off of a skincare niche site. they're not seen as a skincare guru. They're just, they just have a site that probably doesn't have their name on it, but they're making money from it. So it depends on which route you want to go. If you want to be branding your name and branding your site, or you're just trying to make an income off of it. Depends on what your goal is.
Well, that's the thing. That's why I started out by saying authority sites are an investment. If it's something that you want to do long term, and I think their time frame was a year and a half or more, and I think those are kind of arbitrary numbers. But if it's something that you foresee yourself doing long term, and you do want to build this platform, this following, this foundation, then it's something that you're like, okay, maybe it will take me 6 months or a year before I ever think about monetizing it. The important piece is that I build this, whatever this is, this platform, I build this authority site. And then once it grows to a certain level, then I can think about monetizing it. Whereas, and so you're not so rushed. You can be more methodical about building it and building it the right way. And use, you know, all white hat SEO techniques. So you're not doing anything risky. Whereas these micro niche sites, if you're putting $50 and 5 to 10 hours total into each one, you're a lot more likely to go with gray hat or even maybe some black hat things. And you're willing to risk the Google bombing you in the rankings, because maybe the risk outweighs the, or the reward outweighs the risk or something like that. You're a lot more likely to just kind of try different things and test different things for these micro niche sites that you wouldn't be for your authority site. So they're completely fundamental differences. And maybe even going back to what I was saying about having these little smaller niche sites that then grow and become popular and you want to transform them to authority sites. That might be something you run into where you use some gray or black hat techniques to grow that micro niche site. And then all of a sudden you decide, hey, maybe this should become an authority site because it's doing so well and I can maybe see this vision to grow it. Well, I've heard of people doing that before. And then when they do grow it to a point, then all of a sudden those, you know, black hat techniques come back to bite them in the ass and their authority site's ruined because of what they did before. So I really think you have to decide ahead of time what it's going to be and then just kind of go all in that direction.
Nice. Well, I mean, we can ask her if she's tried any of those black hat type techniques and the results from them, or if she just all white hat. I mean, I'm sure she'll open up about that, but let's not dwell on any more about this. Let's get to Jill in the main event.
It's time for the main event.
For the main event today, we have Jill Stanton. Jill hates the word guru, so I'll call her an affiliate marketing magician. She learned her affiliate craft from her hubby and business partner, Josh, and they currently make over six figures just on their affiliate sales and travel the world in the process. Their authority site is Screw the 9 to 5. Jill, what's happening?
What's happening? Thanks for having me on.
So you're in Thailand right now, is that right?
I am. I'm in Chiang Mai, Thailand.
Chiang Mai. What language is it?
But not for long.
But not for long. Tell them where you're moving to.
We move to the Philippines tomorrow.
Oh, goodness.
So just, you know.
Joining the duck crew over in Cebu.
Yeah, I'm going to go work at his co-working space for a bit.
Nice. You're going to have to let us know how it is. He talks well of it, but you can't always trust what Chris has said. So.
Oh, I'll give a totally unbiased opinion.
We just got to meet Chris at New Media Expo, so
did you go to his talk?
Yeah, he's great. It's just meeting him in person without a video camera or anything. He's such a cool dude. It's funny.
Well, let me hop in here while we're talking about Chris. Jill, I don't know if you heard this story or not, but this is how cool Chris is. His talk, so there's different categories of tickets you could get at New Media Expo. So you could get the very basic ticket, which only let you into the exhibit hall, which why someone would buy a ticket to get into the vendor hall, I have no idea. But that was the bottom level. And then the top level was like all access to all the classes. And there was one room that you could only go to those classes if you had that top level. Mm-hmm. Well, somehow Chris Ducker, his session got put in there and he didn't know about it. So when his session came, they were turning a bunch of people away at the door. And Chris was like, what the hell's going on? Why are people being turned away at the door for my talk? And the people were telling him, that's the rules, that's the rules. So Chris stood outside the door behind everybody and says, I'm not going to go in there and start my presentation until all these people are allowed to come in. So there was all this ruckus and all these people were screaming and all the employees for New Media Expo didn't know what to do. Well, if you know Chris at all, Chris won. And about 10 minutes later, he got in there and gave a presentation to a packed house. So yeah, Chris is a pretty badass guy.
Yeah, he's such a rad dude and he's so full of energy. I just get such a kick out of him. So baller. I'm excited to spend a few months with him.
That's awesome. Yeah, he's a baller. Well, Jill, getting into you, because this isn't about Chris. Chris, this isn't about you. This is about Jill.
Backseat. He's taking a backseat to this one.
Backseat, Duckster. For but well, before we dive into the piece of content, we always ask is there a certain podcast you've been on or anything where it tells your story? And maybe I know I've seen you also with your husband as well on a show that tells your backstory really well.
I think probably Sean Malarkey's Money Pillow or Natalie Sisson's Suitcase Entrepreneur podcast. I think I got into my story quite a bit there, but I mean, I'm always down to talk about it.
No, we don't do that. We don't talk about that.
So. Okay, yeah, sorry. Let's just get straight into the Smackdowns.
It's Smackdown City. All right. We looked at a post that, well, it's actually a video you guys did about the difference between authority sites and niche sites. And you guys, you make a lot of your money off of niche sites, but you're building up this authority site, Screw the 9 to 5. So are you trying to start making more money with that instead of the niche sites? Because is that drying up, or are you testing which may be better in the long term, or what's your strategy for that?
Well, we actually have two other authority sites, which is the two we initially started before Screw the 9 to 5 even existed. And we have a skincare site, and then we have a beauty site as well. So those have, you know, like 300 posts on each. They're much bigger than Screw the 9 to 5, and they actually make the majority of our money. Niche sites have come into play maybe like early last year, and they just started working so well that we just started to scale those because they're so small and so easily scalable. We just had a great team in place who pretty much did everything for us from, I mean, Josh does the niche research and the keyword research. And then from there, we have our team who does the site setup, the content, the linking, and all that sort of jazz. So the skincare and beauty sites are our main money makers, but we do have some niche sites that are quite small and, you know, bring in fairly good cash. But it's funny because recently, about a few months ago, we used to be so intertwined with our businesses. Like, we both did the affiliate sites and we both did Screw the 9 to 5, and it was too much. You know, we just always were battling for the last word, and, you know, happy wife, happy life. So chances are I got most final words. Josh probably wasn't thrilled about it. So we decided to, he takes the affiliate side of things because he loves that. And I just sort of really didn't care. And I take Screw the 9 to 5 because that's really what gets me jazzed. So it's very much separate. Like, we each still have a say in it, and he's obviously still involved with 9 to 5 with the videos and whatnot, but I do all the content and stuff like that. So it's not a huge moneymaker yet by any means, but I would love to get it to the point where it's like, I always say to Josh, like, just give me a few months. My business is going to crush yours. So that's the goal. But I want to do it through mostly like webinars and training programs and, you know, stuff that can actually help people get out of their soul sucking jobs and into a life that they love. So that's the plan.
And are you talking about the authority site, right? You're not talking about with a niche site, you're just trying to make money. That's it. Is that correct?
Yes. Niche sites are mostly there to make money. I mean, we have a really great content writer, and she writes fantastic content. So it is still helpful. They do still solve a problem. But for the skincare and beauty sites, they are much more branded. They have a social presence. They have a newsletter, a following. So that's much more involved. But what I meant was for 9 to 5, like it's not a huge moneymaker yet, but I want to get it to that point with training programs and webinars and stuff.
Well, something I found interesting on the Screw the 9 to 5, and this, I don't know if you really would consider that an affiliate site, even though you do have some affiliate links, but your affiliate links are kind of buried there. You got to go through the whole choose your own adventure type path before you get to some of the different affiliate links you have. But on your regular, I guess, what you call niche sites, are they as buried there? Or are they a little more in your face and prolific about, you know, click here and that's where I get my money kind of thing?
Oh, yeah. That, they're very straight to the point. Like, you go through the content, and at the bottom, I mean, we have affiliate links peppered throughout the content in the niche sites, but always at the bottom, I always think it's like super important and the most high converting to have a link and a call to action at the very bottom of your post that says something to the effect of like, click here to learn more from the official website or something along those lines, whatever you find works best for you. But for Screw the 9 to 5, we do have some affiliate links. Like, we're affiliates for like Longtail Pro or Bluehost or Niche Site Theme and all these kind of things. But the Choose Your Own Adventure, that's all our own services. So keyword research, website setup, content creation. We have a personal blog network that we're starting to rent out. All those are our own services that we do ourselves. Those aren't affiliate links.
Okay, very cool. Yeah. We'll make sure in the show notes to link to the Choose Your Own Adventure because I always loved those as kids, the Choose Your Own Adventure. And then I was looking through your site, looking through your site, and I could just keep clicking through and deciding how my journey goes. So I thought that was pretty awesome. It was pretty unique.
Thank you.
Yeah. So something Joe and I talked about, and you touched on a little in the video, but do you, when you're starting your site and you're not sure if it should be, you know, a super hardcore authority site, like in the beauty niche that you guys are in, do you have to decide right away, is this going to be an authority site or is this going to be a micro niche site? Or can you kind of just flounder in the middle for a little bit and then decide later on?
I mean, I always think it's best to probably have a strategy right out of the gate. But for a niche site, technically niche sites target one product. So they deal with one specific issue. So like my skincare site, I have about 10 different subcategories like anti-aging, acne, skin lightening, stretch marks, scars, all that sort of stuff. And then for a niche site, it would just be something like skin lightening, just pushing one product. You know what I mean? So that's the difference. So if you're starting with a niche site, typically you're going for a branded keyword. Like we have a case study running right now on Screw the 9 to 5 where we're showing people how we openly create and monetize and build a niche site. So one of our sites is called My Natural Full Review. So that is a branded keyword. That is a very hard thing to make into an authority site. I mean, I guess you could keep writing on, it's about natural breast enhancement. And I guess you could keep writing on it if you really wanted to, but could you get that up to 200 posts? I don't know if you could. But something like our skincare site, which is much more of our own personal, quote unquote, personal brand, is it lends more to different topics. So we have a ton of different skincare reviews, of course, that cover subtopics or 10 different subcategories, excuse me. But then we also have, you know, even more DIY remedies that help people achieve like natural face masks or natural acne remedies or natural skin lightening, all these kind of things. So that's what draws people into our sites. That's what we use for Facebook and Twitter and Pinterest and our newsletters. And then in those posts, in the DIY posts, we then link to our product reviews. So it's much more of a soft sell. It's much more of a soft funnel, I guess you could say, rather than just like, check out this review, check out this review, check out this review, because that's boring and who the hell wants to listen to that? So that's given us great success so far.
So do you have a passion for these authority site topic, this beauty and this, you know, all this stuff? Is that something you have a genuine interest in and that's why you're there? Or was it purely, you know, keyword research that led you down that path?
I mean, at first, I definitely didn't. At first, I really, really struggled with writing for it all the time because I was having to crank out 2 posts a week plus newsletters plus guest posts. Like I was writing about like 5 to 7 guest posts a week for this. So I was like cranking out content on skincare and I was just getting really disenchanted with it all. But I just started to work to reframe my mindset on it and start focusing on, well, it's the lifestyle that I'm after. That's what I actually have the passion in, is building the business and seeing how it all works and figuring out all the moving parts for it. And then once we were able to, I outsourced that right away. So the writer we have actually does really dig natural remedies and skincare and all this sort of stuff. So it was a good match. So I sort of extricated myself from that and started focusing on more like high leverage activities for that site.
Well, when I was doing research, I read that you had over 18 or so niche sites. I don't know what the accuracy of that number is now, but since you're creating all these different sites, and I mean, for lack of better words, they'll have lesser quality of content than an authority site, don't you feel, isn't there a little feeling of feeling sleazy or scammy in a certain way?
No, because a lot of those, like for the niche sites that we do, we try and target most of the products we've already covered on some of our authority sites because we know they convert. So for some of the niche sites, we've already tried the products. So we can absolutely either embed in a YouTube review that I've already shot that helps, you know, lend it a bit more authority or give a really unbiased product review within it. If, however, we haven't tried it, I try and use the like Derek Halpern method where when he was doing a beauty site, which is funny to think that he used to have a beauty and makeup site, he would synthesize other people's reviews. So he reads through them, sees what the main points are, includes some customer reviews from actual customers, maybe on Amazon or whatnot. And then he creates his or used to create his reviews in as unbiased way as possible, which is what we try and do for the niche sites with the products we haven't tried. Like, I'm never trying to outwardly sell a product. It's never like, oh, I tried this and it was awesome and you should buy it and there's no other solution around. It's never like that. Like, I really think that it's important to always include like a what I didn't like section or why this product is bad. So just for an example, on our skincare site, which is probably our biggest, we have a review on an acne product that we tried and it was just total crap. And so we wrote a whole review on why it's totally crap. And it's one of our highest converting. So like, I think it's important to be as honest as you possibly can. And that's what people resonate with. They don't want to just read, you know, nonstop fluff and like, oh, this is the greatest product I've ever tried. And you have a whole website full of, you know, buy this because it's amazing. They actually want to hear, you know, why it might not be so amazing or where its shortcomings might be. So if you can highlight that as well, I think that sort of helps to lend to the honesty of your post.
Well, I guess rephrasing my question, for if someone's just starting out and they're creating 20 niche sites and they're churning out this content or whatever, just trying to sell these products, because like you said, these niche sites are just to make money. Will they feel at some point that, hey, I'm not really providing value to anyone, I'm just trying to make money, that they're going to want to start an authority site like Derek Halpern's that you mentioned him, that they're going to feel an emptiness at some point, that they're going to just want to try and do an authority site after that? Does that make sense?
Yeah, of course. And I'll just be clear, like Josh and I never say that this should be your only method of ever making money online. This is just the easiest way we know of to help replace your income. So that's the whole point of niche sites. Like, we're not saying, oh, make your entire career around building 300 niche sites. Of course, that would get very boring and you'd really, you know, just lose your love for it. But if you can just, and I'm also not saying build 20 right off the bat. You really have to get your feet wet, see what works, like figure out your system, figure out your funnel, and then start scaling. Like, I definitely don't think it should be something you do right out of the gate. I do think you should get your feet wet with one niche site, see how it works for you, maybe refine your process. Then if you're keen, start a second. But this is mostly just to help you learn a bunch of different online marketing strategies, like setting up a website, setting up hosting, transferring name servers, writing content, SEO, keyword research. Those are fundamental strategies that you need to learn. There's in order to then go on to something else, like a personal brand, maybe a service-based company you want to start, an authority site, possibly drop shipping, maybe. Like, there's so many options for making money online. It doesn't always have to be with niche sites. We just have seen that it's the easiest way to get you out of your job and making money online.
Well, so something Joe and I discussed in round two was, say you've got these niche sites and you've built a couple and they're all kind of trucking along, making, you know, a few dollars here and there, whatever. And then all of a sudden one of them starts ramping up really fast, starts shooting up in the ranking, starts making good money. And you decide, hey, I could totally expand this into a full authority site. I've already got the ranking, so I can leverage that to then build an authority site off this, you know, this foundation. Is that something you've ever done, or you ever would kind of coach somebody to do? Or is it kind of that niche site, you should grow it as big as it can as a niche site, but you should never try to convert one into an authority site?
I mean, if you think you could talk enough, like if you think you could do anything over 50 posts on one specific topic and you just don't want to stop at a niche site and you really want to keep expanding it, by all means, if you can do that, absolutely give it a shot. We personally have never transformed a niche site into an authority site. With our skincare site and also our beauty site, we always started out to make authority site. But the thing is, and I still fully believe in the power of authority sites because they are a long ball game. You can really take a few years to develop it into like a powerhouse of a site. The thing is with those kind of sites is they take longer to make money and rank. However, if you're willing to stick it out, they are what will withstand Google updates. They are the ones that will get the readership, gain the trust of your readers, and, you know, get you repeat customers and repeat visitors. So I always think it's best to choose between one or the other. But with that being said, if you could transform your niche site into an authority site, I mean, it's worth a shot. I just haven't done it myself.
Okay, so let me ask you, when you guys are building your niche sites, are you using different SEO techniques than the authority site? Because one of the problems I would see presented right there would be if you're using a little more gray or black hat techniques for the niche sites, and then you're like, hey, I want to grow this one into an authority site. Well, you put all this time and effort into it, and then Google kills it. Are you using different tactics on the niche sites versus the authority sites?
Okay, so in regards to authority versus niche site with SEO, for skincare, our skincare and beauty sites, we tend to focus on more high leverage, high quality strategies. And for the most part, that was guest posting. So I went on a serious tear and wrote about 300 guest posts because they're more, you know, those links are never going to go anywhere unless that site goes down for some reason or they just don't renew their domain. But those links are permanent. You never have to worry about, you know, having them disappear on you or get de-indexed or anything like that. Plus, you get all these residual effects from guest posting where people continuously find your site through your author bio and having a presence on someone else's site. So that's what we do for our authority sites. We have tried them with a few niche sites and it's worked quite well. However, for our niche sites, we tend to focus more on building a private blog network, which is where you purchase a whole bunch of high authority domains that are just expired, but still have all the links with them. And you create this private network of your own websites that you then use for linking purposes. So that has been hugely beneficial and profitable for our niche sites. So that's what we mostly stick to with our niche sites, because also with blog networks, you can control those links because it's solely up to you. So you can control the quality, you can control the content, you can see whether or not they get de-indexed or if, you know, they just keep on trucking. So those are our two main methods, but we generally always stay away from black hat. We have no interest in that.
Have you ever tried black hat?
Not really, no. We know a lot of people, like in Chiang Mai, there is a huge scene of web entrepreneurs here. So we have met some serious SEOs who do black hat techniques, but they're very much of the mindset that they know those sites are only going to be online for about 2 weeks, maybe a month max before they get de-indexed. But in that time, they make like 20 grand. It's ridiculous. But it's very much of a churn and burn situation. So they churn them out, they get burned, they try again, they do it again, you know. But that's never really interest us whatsoever. So
if you have a student that says they want to try that churn and burn, would you say, hey, you're not a student anymore? Or would you say, hey, go test it for us?
I mean, I would probably try and dissuade them from it, but it's ultimately up to them. You know, I'm teaching, or Josh and I are teaching, a certain model that doesn't really play into black hat. It's not really what we're about. However, there are many sites out there that if they did want to go black hat, they could easily learn all about it. I mean, there's a whole forum called Black Hat World. So if they did want to go that way, that's a huge possibility. We don't know anything about it. So I'd rather not really, like, I don't know, encourage them to go down that route.
Sounds like a good conference, Black Hat World. I think you should start that.
I wouldn't even know what to talk about. I'd be like the worst conference owner for that. I'd be like, so thanks for coming. Anyone want to talk now?
Yeah, exactly. For okay, so as of this recording, there's been a post that's been going around, at least in the online world. I forgot what his name was, but he says that guest posting is dead pretty much. I don't know if you've read that post.
His name is Matt Cutts.
There you go. That's the word.
The head of anti-spam at Google.
Joe's a Reader's Digest version reader here. So, you know, the small specific things, that's not so important. We'll get the big picture.
Exactly. I don't look at the author. I just look at the meat and then I'm gone. So
it gets us into a little trouble, Jill, if you could believe that.
I'm glad you actually brought it up, because a lot of people have written into me about this, and it's funny because I have a training program called Badass Guest Blogging that teaches our entire method for using guest blogging to, you know, grow your email list, grow your social following, make more money, rank in Google, all this sort of stuff. So when that came out, people were like, oh my God, is guest blogging dead? But here's the thing you need to realize about Matt Cutts is that he works for one of the biggest businesses in the world, which is Google. Like, they are a business. They're not just a philanthropic search engine. Their main monetization strategy is ads. So if they see that there is a free method of generating traffic and getting rankings, they're going to do anything they can to vilify that, to scare people away from that, because they cannot control it. So they put out these statements saying guest blogging is dead and blah, blah, blah. But really what they're ultimately saying is this works really freaking well. We can't control it. So we're going to try and convince you that instead you should just buy ads to get your traffic. And the funny thing is a few days later.
Go ahead.
Joe just came to a realization. He's speaking out loud here. I did, actually.
That was like a light bulb moment.
Had an aha moment. But a few days later, Matt Cutts even altered his initial statement and said, okay, guest blogging isn't actually dead. And it's still a fantastic strategy for community, for outreach, for brand awareness, and all of those things that existed before Google and will still exist after it. So it's still a high leverage way of driving links to your site. And not only that, not even just driving links, but getting your name out there, targeting like specific customers within your specific industry, building your email list. That's been one of my greatest outcomes of guest blogging, and your social following. So it's actually a ridiculous way of promoting your website. It's just, they don't want you to know that.
I think it's funny. Anytime Matt Cutts comes out with some kind of article or something like that, then all of a sudden that's the topic of the internet for the next couple weeks. When I search just guest posting dead, I get his articles at the very top, and then it's followed by a bunch of titles that are something like a guest post about guest posting being dead. So it's almost like everyone tries, you know, it gets, you know, laughing in his face about it, and everyone wants to try to, you know, rebel against anything he says. So I just think it's funny the web's reaction to anything he says.
Of course. And like, even when they do their major updates, and he always says like, oh, this is to results. If you ever look, I mean, I'm sure people who don't really pay attention to online marketing or SEO for that matter would never notice this. But if you actually pay attention, all the search results are massively skewed towards these huge websites like WebMD, Amazon, WikiHow, Wikipedia, all these Oprah.com, all these massive content networks that no one could ever outrank. So it really doesn't show any variation, which is ultimately their main goal. Is they always want to have great variation, but when they come out with these updates, like the recent one, Hummingbird, it skews their search results. So it's people get all up in arms, and then he comes out with this guest blogging is dead, and people are like, oh, I'm having into the internet. And it just ultimately, within a few weeks or a few months, it calms down and things go back to normal. It's just, I mean, the thing I try and keep in mind is Google has got to have maybe quite possibly the biggest PR network or PR team behind them that can spin a story in such a ridiculous way that for people who aren't really quite SEO savvy or online marketing savvy would just be like, okay, done. I'm never guest posting again in my life. But ultimately, that's just them trying to scare you away from something that takes away from their bottom line.
Well, Jill, be honest with us here. As a eat what you kill type entrepreneur right now, when you see something like this blow up online, are you just seeing the dollar signs in the distance saying, all right, my guest blogging course is now perfectly lined up to start capitalizing on this because all these people are scared of it. And here you are, you know, the shining light in the distance showing how you can still use guest blogging and you're kind of the savior for all these people in distress.
I mean, that's the greatest explanation I've ever heard, but I didn't see it like that initially. It freaked me out at first until I realized what was happening. And just like anyone else, I read a bunch of blogs and was like, oh, okay, see what they're doing. Because this isn't the first time they've done this sort of thing. You know, I've been doing affiliate marketing for only 2 years. Josh has been in it for 7 years. He's seen like such a drastic change in how their algorithm works. And ultimately, you just have to like take a step back and really view what it is they're trying to do. So, I mean, I don't mind being a shining light, but I think I still have an uphill battle with convincing people that it's not dead, but that's okay. That's a challenge I'm willing to take on.
Well, speaking of Josh real quick, is he looks like he might have some black hat in his past. Is he a reformed black hatter?
He's not. He actually isn't. He's done gray hat, but he's definitely never done black hat. I mean, unless you are of the mindset where you're comfortable with churn and burn, he's just never had an interest in that. Plus, it's a lot of freaking work. And not only that, but it takes quite a bit of an investment. So we've just always just stuck to white hat. And I mean, he has a man crush on Alex Becker from SourceWave. So, and Alex Becker does a lot of gray hat stuff. So he doesn't mind a few gray hat techniques here and there, but mostly it's white hat.
Well, I'm gonna be straight here. You don't look like the person who does like internet stuff. You look like a an interior designer or something
that is random.
Jill, I promise you, he means that as a compliment.
Yes, it is. It's a compliment. Trust me, it's a compliment.
Interior design. No, incorrect.
So what are you saying is you're not some, I don't know, what do you picture an internet marketer being, Joe? Some fat guy sitting in a closet with glasses? I don't know. I don't know what you're comparing it to.
Why did I picture a fat guy with glasses?
I'm talking more in the Y chromosome space with women. You don't see a lot of them. And then the ones that you see, they're not, I don't know, pleasing to look at, I guess. So
Joe, you're delving into new areas on this podcast.
I think we are. I'm trying to get something for the ladies out there. That's where I'm trying to go with this.
Here's a juicy one.
Joe, is this going somewhere, Joe? Or are we?
I'm trying to target the ladies in our audience because some may feel like.
I want to kick Dan off this topic or off this call and just chat, you and I.
There you go.
Joe, do you want me to give you the shovel so you stop digging your hole deeper here?
I'm not explaining it very well, but I know there's women out there that they feel like all this type of web niche site stuff is for nerdy guys or not for women. And I just want to hear what a woman says to that type of comment.
I mean, I have been involved online since about like late 2006. It was just never in online marketing in this capacity. I had two web shows before this. So I've always been interested in video marketing and that side of things and branding and content marketing. But just from when I met Josh and saw him, you know, living this crazy life where I first met him when he was living in China, just like randomly living in Beijing, running a group of programmers and stuff. And his lifestyle just captivated me. And I was like, teach me the ways. Because at the time I had just wrapped up my second web show and I was running a social media business and my time was very much dollars for hours and I hated it. I hated that he could take a 4-day weekend if he wanted to and go somewhere and I was just sitting there like, erg, I have to send out 20 tweets today and it sucks. So I very much said to him, like, I want to learn how to do this. And now that I'm in it and I'm in Chiang Mai, which is, like I said, a massive hub for web entrepreneurs. It's not just me. It's mostly men, but there are a lot of women here who are carving out their own path in online marketing. May not be niche marketing, but like a bunch of the people that I have on Screw the 9 to 5 are women looking to do this, which is massively encouraging. And I'm absolutely happy to help them do it because it is a great lifestyle if you can figure it all out.
I want to talk about that lifestyle a little bit because you see all the people going over to Asia and doing these things. Do you feel like you're actually more productive and you do better work because of that environment and because kind of those like-minded people around you? Or is it just really, you know, badass to be over there in a tropical place and, oh, by the way, you can work there too? Is your work better there or is it just a different environment that you're in?
I mean, column A, column B.
A little bit of both.
A little bit of this, a little bit of that. I'm from Toronto, and Toronto, it's just when we were living there, we had, okay, so I was living in Australia and then we went to New Zealand and then we went back to Toronto for about just under a year. And we were just like, it sucks the life out of you. I know a lot of people like Toronto, blah, 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 blah. But for us.
Well, the mayor does crack, so, you know.
But yeah, I mean, right? How is that not a good place to live?
It's got to be a party all the time.
But for us, there was just no one there doing what we were doing. Like, there's a startup scene and there's a social media scene, but there's not really an online marketing scene. There wasn't anyone who wanted to travel with their business, and there wasn't anyone who sort of wanted to hack their productivity or hack their lifestyle or all this, you know, all these buzzwords. And then we found a podcast called Lifestyle Business Podcast, which is now Tropical MBA. And subsequently, those two dudes, Dan and Ian, own a forum called the Dynamite Circle, which we joined while still in Toronto and being like, no one gets us, this sucks, blah, blah, blah. We find this forum and it's a massive community of people doing exactly what we're doing, whether they're in the States or South America or the UK, but the majority of them are in Asia. A, it's much cheaper to live here, so you can outsource a lot of your work and scale your business way more quickly than ever being back in the Western world. Plus, it's just kind of rad living in a place that doesn't have so many rules. I know that sounds crazy, but there is literally like anything goes here, and it's such a cool vibe. Like, there's no restrictions. There's no like, oh, you can't park on that side of the street between this time and this time because that's illegal. Like, it's none of that ridiculous bullshit. It's more so like, you know what, do your thing, build your business, just be a decent person, and you'll have such a great time here. It's full of people who want to talk business, want to like share strategies, want to help you out, want to get them help themselves. And it's just a vibrant community of people who are like really trying to live an unconventional life, which is what we really vibed with.
And damn it, if the monkey got to that parking spot first, it's the monkey's parking spot. You can't do a right? damn thing about it.
Or chickens. There are a lot of chickens in Chiang Mai.
Oh, God.
So does that mean there's a lot of eggs for breakfast, or are they not those kind of chickens?
No, there are a ton of eggs for breakfast.
Just pick them up off the, you just pick them up off the street and crack them on the sidewalk.
Well, maybe not that much, no.
Okay.
There's a lot of eggs
here. So for someone looking to, if they're looking to break in online, you're saying the best way is to start with a niche site, not to start on the authority site, just because you may get discouraged faster with an authority site rather than a niche site, right?
I mean, it's easier with a niche site, that's for sure. And you can cut your teeth easier with it. Like, you can really start to hone your skills and figure it out. And then from there, you can move on to an authority site because you'll sort of figure out more of the lay of the land. You'll be able to figure out and like spot a really good niche easier than if you were to just be like, I'm going to choose baby strollers, and then you're stuck with baby strollers, you know, like, whereas if you targeted like a mom blog that helps busy moms, but it's an affiliate site, that's a really damn good niche because moms need a lot of help and there are a ton of products. So if you could start with something like baby strollers, see that it's profitable, and then be like, huh, maybe I could create a site for busy moms on the go or whatever the hell you're going to do. And that's your authority site. You know what I mean? So you see that there's potential within a small niche, and then investigate further into the bigger niche and then start your authority site. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So for someone starting out, what should they, I guess, what do you usually expect to receive percentage-wise for affiliates? Because you say, I mean, you say in other in some of your other posts, or actually you say it in this one as well, that you shouldn't expect to make a lot of money the first 3 to 6 months.
So with an authority site.
With an authority site, yes. So with a niche site, you could start making money right away. So what's the percentage of, if you sell something, are you just using Amazon links and ClickBank and all that, or are there some other special ones that maybe we haven't heard of?
Yeah, of course. I personally loathe Amazon affiliate programs because their commission is like 4 to 8%. Like, that is the most you'll ever make, is 8%. And that just to me is bullshit. So the ideal is to find a product that has its own affiliate program. Now, the reason behind that is because they typically have more money to put into their marketing and into their marketing funnels, into their branding. Their programs go down less often. They pay more often on time, and you know, they just have more to put into it. Whereas if you choose to promote a product through an affiliate network such as OfferShot or ShareASale or More Niche or Market Health or Commission Junction or ClickBank or I can't think of any more right off the top of my head, but I mean, there's five or so. If you can go that route, then there's that's still a viable option because they have hundreds of products listed on their networks that you can then go through and see which would be a good fit for your site and apply to their affiliate program. And generally, they have a higher commission. So anywhere from usually 10% and up. I mean, we promote some products that have 50% commissions. So those are obviously, those are badass. And then, like I said, if you can find a product that has its own affiliate program, then that is the holy grail.
Have you tried drop shipping?
Actually, funny you mention that, because Josh is just starting to dip his toes into that now. So a lot of people here in Thailand and just in a lot of people in Vietnam as well do drop shipping. So we're pretty intrigued by it because I see it as the next logical step after affiliate marketing. Like affiliate marketing, you're sort of capped at how much money you can make or how get unless you start scaling your efforts. But with drop shipping, I mean, the sky's the limit because you're essentially buying wholesale and then selling at a marked up price. And it's not so heavily reliant on content. It's more so reliant on just finding a good niche. So
last question. If someone is looking to do something, say they're trying to do an authority site or whatever, number one, do they need a partner, as in like Dan as my partner? Or second, do you recommend for most people to do something with their spouse?
If you can figure out a way to do it with your partner, with your spouse or your boyfriend, your fiance, whatever, I think that's a great way of doing it. It's worked for me. However, with that being said, I think that you need to split things. So someone takes like the SEO tech side of things and the other takes the content and the branding and like the outreach. I think that it's important to each have your own categories for what you do, because then you're not stepping on each other's toes so much. You're not second guessing, oh, should we really build a site like this? Like, that's one person's job, and the other person's job is to get the content up there and to get the links and, you know, to really brand the site. However, what was the first part of that question?
Well, I was asking, do you need
necessary to have a partner? Yeah. I don't think so. Like, if you actually want to do it just yourself, you can easily outsource a lot of this work. However, I still think it's good to dip your toes. If it's just going to be you, it's important that you at least have a basic understanding of all the moving parts of it, so that if you do want to outsource it and that outsourcer falls through, you're not just sitting there in limbo being like, oh shit, what do I do now? You know what I mean? If you are going to go it alone, you should probably, just try and get acquainted with all the aspects that go into running your site. Fortunately, with stuff like WordPress and all these affiliate networks, it is easier to do than, how it used to be a few years ago. So it is possible to do it alone. Absolutely. I know a bunch of people who do it alone, but just in my experience, it's been mega helpful to have Josh there helping me as well. So
love
you it. Could go both ways.
Happy wife, happy life. That's the motto.
that's Josh's new motto for life.
Exactly. Well,
I'm
Gil,
tell him that when he gets back from me.
his meditation. He's going to come back with some like profound insight that says, actually, it's supposed to be happy husband from his meditation.
Well, and he's going to come back wondering who this Joe guy is hitting on his wife during a podcast interview.
That's what happens when you go on meditation retreats.
Yeah, he's just going to come back all enlightened. And no, it'll never be happy husband, happy life. That doesn't even rhyme.
I'll have to think of one. Well, Jill, we appreciate you coming on. So what are you guys working on right now?
Well, I am just continuing to work on, so I have a thing called the 7-day escape plan, which people can sign up to. And I teach the basics of how to set up your first niche site. And I'll be running or opening a training program called Lifestyle Affiliate in the next few months. So that's my main focus, that and webinars for badass guest blogging. So a little bit of both.
A little bit of everything. Well, Jill, thanks for coming on. We appreciate it.
Thank you guys so much.
Well, that's going to do it for this week's episode of the Entrepreneur Showdown. Thank you so much for joining us. And we'd love it if you join us every Monday morning to hear the latest episode of the Entrepreneur Showdown podcast. Remember, the place to go to find the show notes of today's episode and a whole lot more is www.entrepreneurshowdown.com. And while you're there, leave us your email address to find out about upcoming guests, latest episode releases, and a whole lot more.